Welcome back to the Saving Delaware History podcast for a continuation of our examination of the history of Avery's Rest. Today, we're speaking with Miss Julianne Dana, who studied Avery's Rest for her master's thesis at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Boston is, coincidentally, where the Avery family lived prior to their move to Lewis, Delaware. So I guess my first question is, why did the Avery family move from Boston to Delaware?
Well, there's probably not a whole lot of opportunity for them in Boston. Boston was a very booming town. It was very busy. And just like today, housing and land probably would have been more expensive there. John didn't seem to have any land when he married into Sarah's family. So this was kind of an opportunity for them to be able to make a space for themselves, make a space for themselves. There was probably also... It was probably healthier to be out in the country rather than in a city a lot of times because of the spread of disease and a few other things. And this also may be a political move or a religious move for them. We're not entirely sure, though, as there's not a whole lot of records of the Averys living in Boston. It seems that they moved pretty quick after John and Sarah got married.
So what was Boston life like for them before their marriage?
We don't quite know. John moved back and forth from Boston to London a few times where he was originally born. He was born in London. And once his mother was widowed, she eventually went back to London. So there's not a whole lot of record of them in Boston. Now, that being said, I don't think there's been a ton of research. And obviously, there's many, many, many records that people have not really looked at yet, especially in relation to this one specific person. So there could be more information out there. This is always an ongoing project. But it was probably a move, you know, that they would have been happier to be at closer to the top of the social ladder, maybe than in the middle at Boston.
That makes sense. What sort of clothing was within the means of the Avery family?
It's really hard to tell. This is, especially when they were in Boston, they probably would have been trying to dress pretty humbly and frugally as per the Puritan lifestyle that was very commonly seen in Boston. We do know there were laws called sumptuary laws, and those were laws that specifically restricted what individuals were wearing in Boston at that time. So a lot of them were based on religious beliefs, and it would have been items such as not wearing lace or gold to not be quite so in your face and to be more humble about who they are as a person here on earth under God's supervision. We think they probably were dressing relatively simple there, but you know, they obviously would, I mean, they could probably afford some comforts. So they probably wouldn't have been, you know, quite digging up for scraps or anything as far as their clothing.
So compared to Lewis, how many other Puritans were there in Boston?
We don't really know if there were any other Puritans in Boston. Our main information about the Avery family, or a lot of it at least, comes from the court records of Sussex County at the time, which are a great resource and really interesting. You can see a lot of different names throughout that have different heritages. So names that were traditionally associated with Swedish heritage or with British heritage or whoever, even ones that were associated with different religions, such as Jemima, John Avery's daughter, which is a name traditionally associated with the Puritan religion. So we don't really know, because that's kind of our main record of where things are coming from, and certainly not in the court records. They're not really talking about religion a ton, though it does come up occasionally. But they probably were some of the only ones there, but we also don't know whether they were strictly following these Puritan laws, as there's quite a few instances in those court records of John Avery breaking laws that would have been probably important to Puritans at the time.
And what was rural life in Delaware like compared to the city life that John Avery had been accustomed to?
It certainly would have been quieter. There were not a ton of people in, especially in Sussex County at the time. You know, in Delaware, the main hub would have been in Newcastle, much further north. So this was kind of the backcountry of things, which is good for farming and for creating your own homestead out there. But it certainly would have been hard. It was not, you know, not a walk down the street. It was, you would have had to carve out kind of your own place. We think that John Avery probably took over somebody else's homestead, which was there, although we're not entirely sure. And, you know, he had a good location where he was at Avery's Rest. However, you're not getting creature comforts coming in quite as often as some of the bigger cities of Newcastle or Philadelphia. So you would have had to either make do or do without. This was something that would have been pretty limited in what they were able to obtain.
So as you said, clothing in Delaware functions a lot differently from clothing in Boston. But kind of moving now to the more material subject of your thesis, what artifacts of clothing or personal adornment were found at the Avery's Rest site?
Yeah, so clothing would have been a lot more simple, I think, especially there, because they're not going into town every day. They're not, you know, they're not dressing up for daily life, essentially. They would have been doing chores on the property. And we know that they probably would have been helping out around the house, all the girls in the family and everything. At Avery's Rest, we found a whole lot of personal adornment, enough that I had originally wanted to do a bigger assemblage for my thesis, but there was so much to do with the personal adornment from just these three features that we studied. It was really interesting. So we found buttons and buckles and beads. We found shell and glass beads. We found a stone gorget, which we think was a decorative object made by Native Americans, tiny rolled copper cones. And so there was a lot of items that would have been visible on the body, not as visible on the body, like combs, cloth seals, straight pins, scissors, and thimbles, which I also included in this thesis to kind of create a full picture of what they were wearing, but also how they were creating this image.
What do you mean by features that you studied?
So features are anything in the ground that would have been created by human hands. And these are the ones that we studied at Avery's, or the ones that I specifically studied at Avery's Rest, were two wells that had been dug and a cellar of some sort of building, which we think was probably a storehouse of sorts. And the features are anything like graves are a feature, or, you know, any sort of foundation would have been a feature. It's some sort of man-made creation on the environment.
And how common is it exactly to find items like these belt buckles or buttons in features?
These would have been, they probably would have been relatively common, especially during this time. Keep in mind, we are also missing items that probably would have been used, such as ties and things that you could have, you know, you could have tied an apron on, for instance. That wouldn't have left any trace in the archaeological record, probably. Most of these items are commonly found on archaeology sites. There was a good amount of them in these features, but keep in mind, they're also not having, you know, trash pickup or anything during this time. So once you were done with an item, once it broke, or, you know, even went out of style, for instance, it would have been tossed into these, into either the well or the cellar or whatever it was that would have not been used, at that time.
So if these items are discarded, as you say, how can they be traced specifically back to the Avery family?
So earlier, when they discovered the site, they traced the whole site back to the Avery family. So we know that by being in a certain layer called a strata in the ground, so that they're all part of stratigraphy, which is where exactly things are in the ground in different layers. We know that the ones that went in first are all the way at the bottom. So, you know, you're going to dig a hole for a tree. You're going to put something in the bottom of the tree, and that's the item that goes in first. And you put a tree on top of it, that's the item that goes in last. So we use that method of thinking to determine how old things are. We also know that different layers occur with different events. So in the wells and the cellar, we have different events that occurred. We have in one of the wells, it was started by John Avery. So he started filling in the well. So that's his layer, which is much older and has much older things in it than the later layers, which are closer to the top, which are made by Jemima, his daughter, who comes back to live at the site. So we date artifacts by using this stratigraphy and context and figuring out where things are in relation to each other. And that's how we can determine what's from the Avery family, what's from the what's from the later settlement by Jemima, or, you know, what is even, we have some layers in there that are not man-made, that have just kind of washed in with small pieces of things too.
So what sort of things did you find in these wells?
All sorts of stuff. Wells are kind of a treasure trove of, wells and cellars, especially when they're filled in, are really a treasure trove of material. And this is, there's tons and tons of material culture from this. I can't even tell you, I can't remember how many artifacts are from this, but I mean, it's thousands and thousands of artifacts from these features. And some of them are tiny, and some of them are little straight pins, or some of them are much bigger, you know, pieces of plates or jugs or old metal pieces of things. But you know, this is where they would have kind of dumped things, especially once maybe the well went bad or went dry. They would have put their trash in there to kind of fill it back in.
Interesting. You mentioned specifically that you found buckles and buttons. What else did you find?
All sorts of things we found. I like the straight pins. They're some of my favorites. We found a patten. We found cloth seals. We found scissors and thimbles and beads, scraps of metal. We found a piece of mica, which is a mineral, which is really interesting. We found a button mold. And it's quite a wide variety of items that were in this context, which is really interesting.
How were the button molds used?
So button mold is an item that is traditionally associated with Native Americans. They're kind of rare, and there's not a whole lot of information on them, which makes the one at Avery's Rest even more interesting. The button mold is a divot in a stone that molten metal can be poured into to create a very rough button. We think that Native Americans were probably interested in the buttons that were seen on the Europeans when they were in contact with them, and probably tried to make their own instead of trading for them with the Native Americans, or I'm sorry, with the Europeans. This one at Avery's Rest is interesting because it's made out of slate. And as far as I could tell with my research, there's no slate within a range of Delaware, especially of the site. If you wanted slate, probably would have had to go up to Northern Delaware or to Pennsylvania, which is pretty far. So this mold would have been made out of an item, a material that is not commonly found around the site. And it was actually broken on the edge. So it was never used because the whatever molten material they would have put in that button mold would have probably poured out of the side of it. But it was interesting. It's a neat little design that's carved into it too. So it's definitely unique. It wasn't just to create a functional button, but it instead had some decoration to it, which was pretty neat.
And you also mentioned the straight pins. What particular significance did they have?
They didn't have quite a whole lot of significance necessarily as far as like, being decorative or anything like that, but they would have been incredibly important. These were, you know, they didn't have safety pins. So these would have been used every day to hold clothing on, to for sewing, for basically, you know, I mean, your straight pin, especially if you're using material, is going to be kind of your scotch tape of sorts. So it would have been, you know, a kind of fix-all for a lot of different things, which is really interesting because a lot of times we associate straight pins and sewing with a womanly task. However, this would have been used by probably anyone. And straight pins are actually one of the things that we found the most of in this assemblage.
So how would you use a straight pin in a way that it, because if you found a lot of them, they're just falling off all the time. How is that an effective way to bind things?
I mean, it would have been kind of what needs to happen at the time. So, you know, you didn't have, if you didn't have time to maybe sew on a tie to put it on more permanently, you know, some sort of lacing tie, it would have been, you know, holding on something temporarily. It probably wasn't, you know, specifically used to, for a long-term solution, but, you know, if you're going to quickly, you know, pin your shirt back together or something like that, it would have been used for that.
Absolutely. So most of what we discussed are sort of domestic objects, as you said, associated with women's work, even though they are of great practical importance. But why have we not really talked about any objects of, you know, material importance or personal significance, like a locket or something like that?
I mean, these would have been items that certainly would have been a little bit more curated. You know, if you inherit your grandmother's wedding ring, you're hopefully not going to lose that. So this would have been, the items that we see are definitely discarded for a reason or lost. Hopefully there's not too many that were lost unintentionally, but you know, these would have been items that were cleaned up, especially after John Avery died. We think there was probably a decent amount of clean out that happened, you know, get rid of the old stuff, bring in some new stuff. We know his wife remarried. So she absolutely left the area after he died, not the area entirely, but she moved in with her new husband. So we know that there was an abandonment period. They would have kind of cleaned things up. And we know Jemima came back and cleaned things up too, once she moved back in. So, you know, hopefully there's not a ton of items that held a lot of significance, because they would have been inherited and passed down through the family. We actually think that the scissors that were in there were probably passed down through the family, because they're a nice pair. It seems that when they got to Jemima, they probably broke, but the actual dating style of the scissors is a lot older than that. So they would have been handed down and reused over time. But a lot of these things, you know, we certainly don't see everything, because we, back in the day, you know, you can't run down the street to Walmart to pick up something new. So you need to make it work or fix it or if you wanted to have something like that.
Were there any other notable differences between the stuff left during John Avery's occupation as opposed to the stuff left during Jemima's time?
Jemima definitely had some handed down items, and John Avery had a lot of stuff that was probably brought from Boston with them, since, you know, you wouldn't have been able to purchase a whole lot in Lewis at the time. Other than that, both of them had a good amount of material wealth, whether that Jemima kind of built on her father's wealth. You know, obviously she did inherit property and probably some items as well. So whether she built on that, we're not really sure, but she did have a good life for herself. You know, it seems that, you know, she was able to remarry to marry her first husband, and, you know, seemed to be pretty stable as far as what she could afford.
Did both sort of periods of residencies last the same length of time?
We're not really sure. We are not entirely sure when John Avery moved in and when he moved in permanently. It seems that he might have died somewhere on one of his other properties in the area, for whatever reason. It says that he died at an island somewhere. We're not really sure where that island is, what that meant. Maybe it was another name for part of his property. We're not entirely sure. So we're not sure where he moved, when he moved in exactly, and how much time he spent at Avery's Rest, although it is clear from the amount of activity there that it was a main residence of somebody. And then we have kind of the beginning dates of Jemima and probably some end dates. But again, you know, archaeology is not totally exact when it comes down to that, especially if you don't have all the records for it. And there's not a lot of records. So there's a lot of things that we don't have answers for. Sussex County in general is a very understudied area as far as the archaeological record. So we have the court records, which are really helpful as far as documentary evidence. And we have some other very helpful, documentary pieces as well, such as the Duke of York record. However, it's nothing as compared to the records that would have been kept, you know, in a more populated area in one of the bigger towns. So there's a lot we don't know still.
Certainly. And what sort of, can you give an example of how this archaeological record supplemented that court record?
Absolutely. So it's really interesting, because the court records, and especially some of the items that we see in the court records, kind of put out a framework of, you know, how things would have been in Sussex County during this time. But I think the archaeology really fills in a lot of the blanks. So with John Avery, we know, you know, I mean, they're court records. They're very basic. They're very straightforward. They're very, most of the time, they're very cut and dry, although they can be kind of lengthy. But, you know, they're not going to talk about daily life. They're not going to talk about John going back to, you know, tend to the farm in some way or something like that, or his, you know, his daughters growing up and getting their first teeth or anything like that, you know. So the archaeological record, I think, I like to think, really fills in a lot of the blanks as to who these people were as human beings as, and what their personalities might have been a little bit more.
Certainly, that's the point of doing all this investigative research into these small but significant artifacts. And of all the artifacts that you've studied, which one was your favorite?
So I have a twofold answer to this question, because we talked about it a little bit before, but stray pins are my favorite general artifact. I just think it's such a mundane artifact. It's so basic. There's nothing fancy about it. But especially with some of the ones in this collection that are handmade, way before machine processing started with these, you can actually see on the ends of the pin shaft that, you know, the maker of it wound tiny bits of metal around the top in a spiral to make the head of the pin. I mean, it is so tiny, and you can only see it under a microscope, but it's amazing to me that people, you know, would have made these tiny, tiny items, and they're really hard to find. You know, we find a lot of them, but it's hard to spot those things because they're so tiny when you're screening for artifacts. But my favorite artifact from this collection specifically is a button that is really simple on the front. And it's very plain, and on the back of it, it actually has a gold loop on it. And it's not much gold on it, but why would you have put a gold loop on the back of a button? I mean, this is the loop that's keeping it onto the clothing. This is how the button is attached to this piece of clothing. But why would you put gold there? I mean, why wouldn't you use some other sort of, you know, more basic metal that would have been cheaper? You know, was it because they were keeping the gold kind of close to them to keep it safe? Was it that they didn't have anything else, or they really wanted to fix this button? Was it kind of a memento of sorts? Was it a hand-me-down? We have no idea. I've never seen anything else like that. And it was a really, really odd little piece that was really interesting, and that we're probably just never going to get an answer to, which is fascinating still.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Dana, for personalizing all the stories from the Avery family. And thank you to the listeners for listening.